Good afternoon. This program is a rebroadcast of one first aired in 2006.
From the confines of Jim Crow, Texas, through academic excellence, athletic perseverance, and artistic expression, we continue the journey with painter Marvin Hardin. Hello, this is Stephen DeLucchi, and you are listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program dedicated to the advancement and exploration of the visual arts, produced here in the studios of KCBX Public Radio. Today, we finish a two-part interview with artist Marvin Hardin. Marvin was an instructor at various Southern California institutions of higher learning, finishing his career at Cal State Northridge. Mr. Hardin's works are part of numerous private and public collections. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I met with Marvin at his studio located in the coastal mountains overlooking the Pacific Ocean. We re-enter the conversation as Marvin discusses the importance of lessons learned early on by his participation in athletics and sports.
I'm trying to think of what John Wooden said, and John Wooden is a former coach, right, basketball coach at UCLA, a legend in his own time, believe me.
Right.
He said something about luck is the residue of preparation. I think that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. And I subscribe to that. You know, you have to be prepared because you're not completely in control of your own life. You're not completely in control of your own destiny. If you're an athlete, especially in the kind of sports that I played, you have teammates and you rely on those teammates. You have to rely on the teammates. You have coaches. You have to rely on the coaches to assist you in your goal to get to where you want to get to win the game or whatever it is you're trying to do. And it's the same way as an artist. I can sit here in the studio or stand here in the studio and make pictures. In order for those pictures to be seen, I'm going to need a dealer or a curator or somebody to believe in me. I'm going to need people to simply be messengers of word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And hopefully someone will place some of the work in an institution someplace so that the work becomes part of the fabric of the long continuum of Western art, perhaps, or the world's art. So you've got a whole bunch of things happening, or possibly can happen, that you don't really have any control of. Mm-hmm. The only thing you have control of is your own efforts. And if you make that, if you're any good and you're lucky, then you might... You might realize things that you never dreamed that you could realize.
I've always loved it when I'm painting, when they take a whole life and existence of their own completely
yes.
outside of you.
And
you have no idea where this came from.
Right.
It was just like,
right.
Well, that, I guess I did that.
You know, if they don't do that, if you're in total control of the piece, in my judgment, then... you're way within your limitations. Mm-hmm. I would give assignments, and this was particularly in cases for division courses and graduate students, and they were always verbal assignments. I would just say it, and they would have to write it down. And you know, I'd see all these quizzical looks on the faces. They didn't know what the heck I was talking about. The ultimate objective was to utilize the assignment as a point of departure. I mean, they weren't being held to anything because I wanted them to get started, and I wanted the things to grow, and I wanted them to grow out of their control. I didn't want them to be constantly in control of it, because once they got into a big mess, then they'd have to find a way to solve the mess. Mm-hmm. And in the solving of the mess is where the learning took place. Mm-hmm. Because if they stayed within what they could already do, they wouldn't learn anything. You don't learn anything when you already know it.
Well, and I think that that's, if I once again go back to the word discipline, was how I was trying to use it as a compliment and not as something that was a chain around your neck saying
no.
that you were, you know, so precise about everything. That really isn't how I'm using the word. As I look at the overlapping, the layering, the involvement with the piece, it just feels like something that it's obviously in a conversation with you.
Yes.
As you're doing it, but it often seems as though in the final place, you're the one that sort of perhaps had the last word, even though it took you to something else. That it started a conversation, perhaps, in that sense, not the last word.
Yeah, I would think that I would hope, and I'm the last person in the world to be objective about what I do, but I would hope that in the last analysis, each piece has been imbued with my personality and my philosophy and the essence of who I am as a person based on my experiences in my life and my desires and my wants and fears and all of that stuff. I would hope that's the case. But I would also hope that and I think that what you say is implied in what I'm about to say is that when I'm doing the work, like anyone else that I might have taught, the work gets it to places where I'm not in control of it, where I sometimes have to scratch my head, not literally, but figuratively scratch my head and not know where I'm going. And I have to, I know where I want to go, but I have to kind of like ponder for a while. Oftentimes when I'm in this space, I'm working very hard, but I'm not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, if you were here to witness it, I wouldn't be... I'd seem like I'm being passive, but I'm thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I might be reading a book, or I might be staring at the painting in progress, or listening to some music or something, but I'm thinking about it. And I'm looking at the thing, and I'm thinking, well, where does it go from here? You know, what do I do? You know, is that little brush mark, you know, reading right, or should it be eradicated, or what should happen there? I mean, does it need more stuff down here? Or, you know, you're thinking about it, and you're trying to make it all work. And then sometimes you get to a point where you just can't save it. And you just simply scratch it or scrape it or start all over or paint over it and all that kind of stuff. And my philosophy about that is that from the time you start on a blank sheet of paper, or blank canvas or blank panel or whatever it is you're doing, whatever the support is, from the first mark to the last mark is a kind of life story, life history of that piece that you're layering that thing with all kinds of marks. When you see some wrinkled elderly guy with a, you know, old beat up hat or something and beat up boots, and you can read the hard work and the exposure to the sun and all of that stuff, you can kind of read that by what you see, because that face is a product of its own personal history. And that's what the pictures are, ultimately. They were born at some place, and they eventually come to a point of their final whatever it is that they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think we're wanting to use final in that context, being that they just died. So,
hopefully they don't die. Sometimes they do die. I had a lot of work that died in 1970. I had a lot of work that burned up in 1970. But that's not what I mean.
Yeah, I know it isn't.
They get completed to be whatever they are, the color and the value and the textures.
And at that point, it's ready for its next life, which is anybody else taking a look and making that interpretation is being done on their own.
Yes.
Their own life, as opposed to
bring
Marvin Hardin saying
they have
this
to bring themselves to it.
And it seems like we certainly have been in an era of, I don't know when we can really say it started, but the need to, or the supposed need to explain everything away.
Yeah, I think you explain the magic away when you do that myself. You know, you need to just let it be. And you know, I have a lot of friends that talk about their work. They even go on lecture tours, you know, and they go in and they put the slides up and they talk about their work. I think I was about the only one at Cal State Northridge on the faculty that I can recall, the people that I knew, that didn't bring their slides of their work in, and sometimes the actual work, and talk about it with their students. And I never did that. I never brought my work in. I never brought my slides in. And they would ask me to do it, and I would decline. For many years, I wouldn't even tell my students when I was having a show locally. Stuff would be up. And finally, you know, they started getting on my back when they started hearing about the fact that this stuff was hanging someplace where they could get to it. Then I started thinking, well, that's kind of ridiculous. At least I could tell them, you know, that I'm having a show. But, you know, when you're in a position And I don't know how you feel about this, but when you're in a position of influencing people, and that's obviously what a teacher does.
Right.
One, at least in my case, I had to be concerned, at least I thought I needed to be concerned about how much influence was reasonable, how much was too much. I didn't want a whole bunch of people coming out of there looking like Marvin Harden. That wasn't my point.
Right.
My point was to make each person realize to the greatest possible degree who they were. I wasn't interested in them being anybody else. I wanted them to be themselves. And that is, if they did fine and delicate work, fine. If they did crude and harsh-looking work, fine. Whatever it was, we're going to do it the best that we can do it. We're going to make you do it or help you do it the best that you can do. And, you know, the philosophy, as far as I'm concerned, was to enable people to be the best of whatever it is they were trying to do, whatever they were capable of doing.
Probably what also came across, or what definitely came across for me, and I did have the advantage of seeing some of your work in a faculty show, but I'm not sure that that was the determining factor in knowing that you weren't going to ask anything of me that you weren't asking of yourself.
That's
and
good.
I'm
that's
not sure that, in fact, I'm sure I have not found it in all instructors that I've had in a lot of disciplines, but I think that kind of
commitment
and truth carries through so that people are knowing that you're really trying to support them, as you say, being the best that they can be, because you're trying to support yourself being the best that you can be.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that delicate line between turning out lots of little whatever we are.
Right.
And I've come to realize that there's a certain aspect of that, because they're certainly seeing and conscious of our input,
sure,
whether, you know, whatever it is. But it is certainly that dividing line that I always have hanging in front of me in terms of how do I do this.
Yeah, the issue with people who teach in studio courses is that we do visual stuff. And that can be a very obvious and intense influence on people. People can see what it is and identify with it or be repelled by it. But
right.
but you know, if they identify with it, then oftentimes students want to please the teacher, and students want to find the course of least resistance, because that's the nature of all things. And if they can do anything like what you can do. Sometimes they can't do it because they don't have the skill or they don't have the background and knowledge to do it. But if they can do it, they will mimic you. If you give them that opportunity, especially if you encourage it, which some teachers do. My feelings even about that is that every person has to be who he or she is. And if that faculty member saw fit to teach that way, it wasn't for me to judge that. It was only for me to decide how I was going to be. It's not for me to decide how somebody else is going to be. You know, I'm not that kind of person that feels that what I think is the only way to think. We have too much of that in this society.
You are listening to Ears on Art on KCBX Public Radio. Today's guest is Marvin Harden, an artist with paint and pencil, who has retired after 30 years of teaching at Cal State Northridge, to his wonderful studio here on the Central Coast. Join us as we continue our conversation.
Not quite sure how to ask this question, so I'll just plunge in, I guess.
I feel I'm not commenting.
Where, in terms of the early years of life in a segregated community, obviously when you taught at Cal State Northridge, it was perhaps almost as segregated, but in the other direction in the early years. What kinds of ways have those influences, have they been in terms of what you felt as a leader to students, or where has race and that issue, do you think, taken you in terms of your work?
Well, it's hard to put one's finger on. I could tell you that when I was a student at UCLA, with a very few black students at UCLA, when they went there, we all, if we didn't know each other, like personally, we knew who each other were. Mm-hmm. And I understand, I was told that I was the first black person to earn an advanced degree in the School of Applied Arts, which I thought was really weird. I mean, you know, it felt like as late as this, you know, when I came through here. And I'm not sure if I was the first black on the San Fernando Valley State College campus. That's what it was before Cal State Northridge.
But yes, my diploma is the last one, I think, that is San Fernando Valley State College, Northridge.
I was the first black person, the first minority of any kind in the School of the Arts at San Fernando Valley State that later became Cal State Northridge. And I was the only black person there for all but 3 of the years that I was there in the School of the Arts. And I've caught a lot of racism. There was a lot of stuff. And there were a lot of people who were good people and who were my friends. But there were a lot of people who were in opposition to me because of the color of my skin. But that was exacerbated by the fact that I had the good fortune of having a better career than most of them. So there's a lot of professional jealousy involved right. in that. And it was further exacerbated by the fact that I got most of the better students. I was the chair of more graduate students than all the rest of the faculty combined. And as you know, graduate students at Cal State Northridge do the choosing. So that was, you know, a lot of jealousies and resentment. You know, it's a stressful situation to be in, but I think I was the right person to be there because I had been competitive all of my life and I'm used to dealing with difficult situations. And I don't back down. You know, if you're going to be someone who, not by choice but by circumstance, happens to be in a position of being first at something, then you're going to have to be willing to take, well, not willing, but you're going to have to be able to take the slings and arrows. You're just going to have to be able to do it. Or you're going to have to be a quitter, you know, one way or the other.
And you obviously already had the determination and the conviction about how you wanted to pursue your career as an artist.
Right.
So that didn't have to get interfered with, or did it?
Well, to some extent, at certain periods that happens, you know. Certain periods you get to that point where you feel like, the heck with all of this, I'll just go and spend my time. It was like a combination of losing oneself in one's work in the studio and in one's work with the students and the FaceTime with the students. And one of the things that one feels, and I'm sure either one of you can never feel this, at least not in this society, maybe if you go someplace else in another context you would feel it, but one of the things you feel when you're a minority person, you have a great responsibility. You know that if you don't do things well, it's going to be a long time before somebody else gets an opportunity. Somebody else like you gets an opportunity. And you also know, especially in my case, dealing with students, that the majority of my students had never been around a black person before.
My hunch is that you are the only black instructor I've ever had.
And I had a lot of students tell me that. Mm-hmm. A number of students tell me that.
And when you're in school for 16-plus years, that's a lot of years.
That's a lot of years, not to have much exposure.
And a lot of instructors. And
the other thing that I think would be worthy of saying is that one of the wonderful things about the academic world, especially at the college level, is the exposure to a lot of different disciplines, a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different people with a lot of different expertise. A person like me, I'm aware that I'm bringing something different to the table. I'm bringing that something to my colleagues, and I'm bringing that something to my students. And I think that's an important thing, and I think that's one of the things that this society missed and continues to miss to a great extent, that we are a rich society in terms of variety, and people shouldn't be denied the opportunity to partake of that variety. Because in the last analysis, what is education about?
Exactly. You want to speak to variety a little bit?
Actually, I was just going to say, it's one of the things I'm finding most with so many children being homeschooled now, is that they are not having that exposure to the cultures and the experiences of other people. And I think that they're losing out a great deal by that lack of exposure.
I concur with you.
at least in my personal experience, is that that was the best part of my education, was the fact of, with the other people that I, with which I had to interact.
Yeah, I think people lose sight of what education is about. They think education is about reading, writing, and arithmetic, mm-hmm. but being able to rub shoulders with and debate ideas with people who have different backgrounds from are different from your own is part of the growth process. You know, we've got a situation now where it seems more imperative than ever. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, and I guess you can kind of read into that what you want.
Yeah, it doesn't take much reading. it goes back to me, though, about the detail, mm-hmm. that ability to see, as you say, with much more than our eyes, and to enjoy the process of the interpretation. And if we're only looking surface deep all the time, mm-hmm. we lose much of anything, or most. And perhaps it's still why the phrase, don't sweat the small stuff, it's all the small stuff. And I'm going, wait a minute, that's where life is.
That's right.
You know, we have to set priorities.
It's a composite of small stuff.
But it is a composite of small stuff. Mm-hmm. Right now, with this retrospective that has just happened in Pasadena, kind of in a transition period a little bit before another body of work really gets going.
Yeah. I
mean, so you can look at some more of the small stuff.
Right. Yeah, I don't really ever know where the work is going to go exactly. I mean, I know it's going to be about my life, you know, the things that I'm interested in, but I don't know exactly how the images are going to be turned out to look like this, that, or the other. I just know that they're going to have a very large degree of, how can I say this? They're going to be impregnated with who I am, because I don't see any excuse for making them other than that. Mm-hmm. In the last analysis, the very idea is to express who you are, to have the arrogant assumption, I assume, that somehow you're different to some degree, and that you can show others who are kindred spirits that difference. Not necessarily that they're different from them, but you're different from a lot of people. You have a quirky way of seeing something, mm-hmm. and you want to share whatever that sense of things happens to be to others.
In terms of time frame, you talked about the days, perhaps, or certainly the hours that can go by when you are perhaps staring at something that you've started and in a place where you're not quite ready to be holding the end of the paintbrush mm-hmm. to keep working on it, or the pencil. But is it sometimes days or weeks or months before another piece gets started? Or are you finding yourself somebody who has to be at it every single day with something in motion?
No, it's a mixture. Sometimes I'm working on two things simultaneously. I might work on the drawing at the drawing board and work on an oil at the easel. And I found that to be very useful. I tend to work in oil a lot, and oils are slow drying. And so I find it useful that I can go over across the room and work on the drawing and utilize the time better. But there are many times when I'm working on one thing only, and there are many times when I'm not working at anything in the studio because I have other things to do. You know, I have to go out and mend the fences and cut grass. This place is a fire hazard where I live, and meaning, you know, right. a lot of wild grasses and stuff. And, you know, if a limb blows down, a tree blows down, I have to take the chainsaw out and deal with that. There are all kinds of things to do in a country kind of setting. I find that all a part of it, because if the work doesn't evolve from something, you know, it's pretty much a shallow, hollow thing. Mm-hmm. I might not want to do a lot of things, and a lot of things I don't want to do, especially as I get older, because, you know, my body isn't what it used to be. But I find it necessary to understand that the work evolves in great measure out of your life, mm-hmm. and you have to have a life. You have to be doing something other than just making pictures. Otherwise, where is the picture coming from?
Yeah, I was going to say, the paintings, to me, that's how I communicate with the world. I communicate through my paintings. And as you're saying, if you stop experiencing life, then you have nothing left to communicate.
There you go.
Life is part of it. Painting is just a small little portion of everybody's
exactly.
life. You know, you can't live your paintings.
That's right. That's what I feel about it.
The question comes from the place of certainly having, over the years, people make comments about feeling very desperate in their own life that they're not in their studio every day. And then I look at myself and I go, oh. Maybe
like
I'm really not even doing this. Yeah, I mean, I'm way off the mark here. But I was asking it just because it seems interesting to me that we really do have different styles about how we go about getting to that place. Mm-hmm. Way back in high school, took a dance movement class from a friend of my sister's, and she would do this whole thing about just having her little drum going and beating it and having us get to the floor in 10 counts. And some people might do it in 3, and some people would take 10. Mm-hmm. And the same thing would get it up and just get to know your rhythm, get to know who you are. And it is something that I, you know, certainly talk with students too, is that sense of we don't all do it at the same pace,
that's true,
and we don't all do it in the same format. It just seems interesting to make sure, to sort of double check that once in a while with other people.
Like
is it really okay to be spouting this philosophy?
I had a dealer once, and Irvin Blum, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he handled people like Frank Stella and Ellsworth Kelly and all those New York guys who were so-called superstars. And this was at Blum's. Stella had a show, and then I had a show, and then Kelly had a show. So I was sandwiched in between these two giants, supposedly. And he was telling me this story about Stella, and he said he didn't do anything but make art. No sex, no nothing. That's all he did was, you know, make pictures, make his stuff. I think that's interesting. But I don't think that's anything that I would want to do. But, you know, to each his own.
Marvin, thank you so much for taking the time. Even though you're saying that you're not talking specifically about the work, you're certainly sharing a lot about what it is that you do as a creative individual. And that, I think, is what this program's all about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much for your interest.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a little after 5 p.m. on Sunday, and I've been working at the computer now doing editing of this program for several hours. Spending this much time listening to a conversation certainly makes you very intimate with what people are saying. But my eyes and head have been getting a little tired, and then there's a knock on the door. Go out and see the clouds! I just went out, and it is just one of those sights that just reminds me once again of why we talk about detail, of why we talk about all the little parts. The sky is just filled with layers upon layers of subtle colors, probably just a watercolorist, wet-on-wet dream. For the rest of us, just something you take in and hold. I think Marvin Hardin, with his emphasis on learning how to see, asked me to think differently over 30 years ago. I haven't forgotten it, and I thank him for that.
You have been listening to a conversation with artist Marvin Hardin. For more information on Marvin's work, just enter his name, his last name is spelled H-A-R-D-E-N, into any search engine. You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program dedicated to the exploration and advancement of the visual arts, produced here in the studios of KCBX Public Radio. This is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krissa Hewitt, thank you for listening.